welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 29th of March 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. It's the beginning of another week, and you know what that means. That means we are gathered here today to discuss the weekend's news and all sorts of interesting things that nationalists will find interesting. And of course, that means that I have with me today my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. It's a bit miserable over here where I am. What's it like where you are?
Well, it sort of alternates between being a bit overcast and a bit sunny, but I never complain about the weather because the weather is what it is, and the change of weather we have in the UK is all part of rich tapestry of life in the British Isles, isn't it? So, as I say, I always enjoy the weather as much as I possibly can. I think the really big thing about today, and that's sort of the day when this is going out, which is going to be Monday, the 29th of March, is that it's the beginning of the withdrawing of the lockdown restrictions, which I think will probably be interesting lots of people across the country. And hopefully this will be the end of the last lockdown that we'll see. I certainly hope so.
Yeah, there's lots to really talk about that and get into there. They're talking about vaccine passports for people to get into the pub, and the pub industry have said, well, we can't possibly do this because half the population hasn't been vaccinated, and it's mainly the young people that haven't been vaccinated. So how are they going to have vaccine passports? And it's the young people that actually work in the pubs. We'll just have to wait and see what happens there. And also there will be a lifting on this restriction on protesting, which has caused all sorts of problems over the last week with these protests, the Kill the Bill protests that we talked about in the last episode, and also that I talked about in the Daily Nationalist. That has continued all last week. There were two more protests in Bristol, which is a hotbed of left-wing radicals. I think on the Tuesday, they tried to set up a temporary autonomous zone like the one that was in Seattle last year. They put all these tents up in a public park, and the police stopped it, basically. They prevented that from taking off. And then on the Friday night, there was another violent protest that took place, where the police were showered with bottles and rocks and fireworks were thrown at them, and apparently there was a strong smell of ammonia. So the police, I think they had to wear gas masks. They were concerned that ammonia was going to start being thrown about. A really, really violent situation that is happening there in Bristol. And I really don't think it's a coincidence that last year the Bristol police allowed a mob to tear down the statue of Edward Colston and drag it to the canal and then throw it in the canal, and the police just stood by and watched, and the mayor of Bristol, the black mayor of Bristol, said how proud he was of this and what an excellent example of policing it was to just allow there to be mob retribution on public property. And then we fast forward 6 months, 7, 8, 9 months to now, and the mob thinks it can get away with just about anything, setting fire to police vans, throwing bottles at the police. I think last weekend there were police with broken arms, a punctured lung, broken ribs, all sorts of violence. And we can contrast that with the anti-lockdown protest that took place last weekend, and there was no trouble at them at all. And yet we see all the resources of the state are concentrated on the so-called far-right threat, and yet all we see is a far-left violent threat, and it doesn't seem to be ending anytime soon. I mean, even the title of that protest, the Kill the Bill protest, it seems to me that it's an invitation to attack the police, and I'm sure the people on the left saw it as that. I don't think it's continued. I don't think there were any protests on the Saturday or the Sunday, but once the restrictions lift on the protesting, I think they're going to have serious problems there in Bristol with this mob of anarchists and Antifa. What do you make of these Kill the Bill protests, Max?
Well, I think it's good that we've chosen today really to draw a distinction, because we did it to a certain extent last week, draw a distinction between the left-wing demonstrations that have been taking place in Bristol with the anti-lockdown demonstrations, which were largely peaceful, and what the police need to do is to realize that there are two types of demonstrated in this country, demonstrations by people who love this country and who want to preserve everything that's good about Britain, but who seem to receive the same heavy treatment that is, in many cases, heavier treatment than is meted out to the left-wing demonstrators, and people who, if they were to be in a situation where they had sufficient numbers to overwhelm the police, wouldn't actually cause any damage because they are demonstrating to protect these islands, to protect British culture, British architecture, and the statues of the great people of our past, etc. And so as far as the vast majority of people of this country, and in that I include people of the of a nationalist political persuasion, that they are not likely to cause any damage in the way that we've seen with these Kill the Bill demonstrations that are taking place in Bristol. And you're quite right, the naming of these the Kill the Bill demonstrations it gives you the left the opportunity to incite violence against the police, and I think that it's you're quite right in what you said. I think that as you sow, so shall you reap, and if you praise the flagrant disregard for law and order, then you can't then be surprised if that comes back to bite you. I said last year when the Colston statue was destroyed, I said then that and this is kind of paraphrasing the phrase which is often used about books, you know, where they burn books, so one day burn people. And I said last year that where they destroy statues, they will one day destroy people. And this is coming to becoming this is being proven now with the destruction that's being directed towards the police, and the difference between a demonstration by peace-loving people, people with respect for law and order, and those of the far left and the anarchist fringe and the Black Lives Matter groups, is that the anarchists and the left-wingers and the Black Lives Matter demonstrators, when they have been demonstrating there, they don't like this country, they don't like the people of this country, they don't like the culture of this country, and they want to destroy it. And so when they are in a position where they overwhelm the police by weight of numbers, then they go on rampages of destruction. And that's what the police have got to learn. And the police have got to learn which side their bread is buttered on. And if they want to continue to have the support of the majority of people in this country, or the respect of the majority of people in this country, then they need to apply different methods of severity in policing to the different groups, dependent upon whether those groups are destructive or constructive.
The mayor, I think he's called Marvin Rees. He seems to be proud of this. He's been saying Bristol has a very proud history of protest. Well, protest is supposed to be peaceful. It's not supposed to be a violent mob setting fire to things and destroying things. And that's what we've seen with the left. And yet he's talking about this proud heritage of protest. That isn't protest, that's destruction. What we see is when we see nationalists protesting, or when we see these anti-lockdown protests, there's no violence, there's no threat to the police there. This group, this Kill the Bill group, they've also squatted a police station in London. They've taken over a police station there, and they keep trying to attack this Bristol police station. And I'm not quite sure what their reasoning is, why they keep going for it. But they're certainly very destructive. And I think the general public are just bemused at what is going on, because they read in the press about how there's this big far-right threat, and they read about 13 and 14-year-olds that are just talking in chat rooms, and there'll be a dozen police that descend on somebody's house, and we're told that they're terrorists. And then what we see happening is we see the people on the left setting fire to things, blowing up police vans, destroying police stations, throwing things at officers on horseback. And then we see the mayor of Bristol talking about the proud heritage of protesting. I mean, it is all back to front, and I'm sure people must be scratching their heads and saying, you know, quite what is going on here? As you say, Max, they're trying to destroy the country. They hate the country. They want to destroy whatever they can destroy. Whereas nationalists, we want to build things. We're on the side of the forces of order, and the left are on the side of the forces of chaos. And we don't just see this destructive urge manifesting in the left. We also see a destructive urge manifesting, I'm sad to say, in the Scottish National Party up there in Scotland, who want to split Scotland off from England and break up the United Kingdom. So I was very pleased to see that Alex Salmond, the former leader of the Scottish National Party, has now set up his own party, which is going to split the vote between his party, which is called the Alba Party, and Nicola Sturgeon's party, which is the Scottish National Party. And there's quite a lot of interesting intrigue that's been going on here. Alex Salmond was accused of groping some women. He was Me Too'd, basically, by Nicola Sturgeon. And Nicola Sturgeon had always said that Alex Salmond was her great hero. He was her inspiration and all the rest of it. And yet she set Alex Salmond up for this. She was told that there wasn't enough evidence to go after him and it would just be a waste of money. And yet she insisted that the courts should go after Alex Salmond, even though they knew they weren't going to win. So Alex Salmond was taken to court. He won in the court. And then he made all these allegations of corruption that Nicola Sturgeon knew about this before she let on that she knew about this. She had held secret meetings. And basically the allegation was that the legislature was far too close to the actual government itself. And Nicola Sturgeon had to give these interviews. There was a big investigation, and it was so clear from these interviews that she was so arrogant, and she just knew that she could say whatever she liked because the legislature was going to back her up. And of course the legislature is supposed to hold the government to account. One of them is supposed to be responsible for the laws, and the other one is supposed to be making the laws. That seems to be the difference between the two to me. And there just seemed to be no difference there. Nicola Sturgeon thinks that she can rule the roost, she can do whatever she likes. So Alex Salmond has hit back with this totally by surprise. Nobody was expecting this. He's now come out with this party, the Alba Party, that is going to split the vote. The Scottish election is in May. We've also got George Galloway is in there. He's starting up another party. We've got the Conservatives up there, and they are campaigning on a platform of abolishing Abu Hamza's hate crimes bill. That's the bill that we discussed in an earlier episode where you're not going to be allowed to speak your own mind within your own home. So there's going to be a lot of excitement happening in Scotland over the next month. And I really do think, I hope that Alex Salmond's Alba Party splits the vote, and we may even see the Scottish National Party not get a majority. I would love to see that happen, and I'd love to see loads of support for the Conservative Party, because they're the only ones that are saying they're going to abolish this bill, and that would show that there was a lot of strength there, strength of feeling that the Scots didn't want this horrible, intrusive bill that just does away with free speech completely. So that was a real surprise last week, and also the name of the party itself is quite bizarre. I'll let you bring that one up, Max.
Yes, it's the use of the word Alba. I mean, Alba is a word which is derived from the old British word of Albion, which represents the British Isles as a whole. And Alba has got the same root, although it has tended, the foreshortened word of Alba as opposed to Albion has tended to be used historically far more in Scotland than it has anywhere else in the UK. So it's amusing that he's chosen a word which kind of indicates a link with the rest of the United Kingdom, when the aim of his party is to divorce itself from the rest of the United Kingdom. I just find what's going on in Scotland with regard to the Scottish National Party as just such depressing stuff, really. And all for in a rather foolish cause, because as far as the British Isles are concerned, the enemies of Britain have wanted to break up the British Isles into our component parts for centuries, effectively. There have been conspiracies between foreign governments and Scottish claimants to the throne of Scotland and to the claim to the throne of England, and these have always aimed to try and separate Scotland from the rest of the United Kingdom. But anybody with any wit will see that that Scotland is too small a country in terms of its population, in terms of its size. It doesn't have the critical mass to function as an independent nation state in the world as it is today, or as it's ever been, I don't think. The same goes for Wales. The same goes for Northern Ireland. And the same probably goes for Southern Ireland as well. I can remember attending a function in Southern Ireland many years ago, where I was I sat a bit further down the table as we were having dinner. There was a very loud gentleman who was an officer in the Southern Irish Army, who was making all sorts of pronouncements in aimed at trying to wind me up about the fact that we were in era, and it was an independent country, independent from Britain, etc. And I just remarked, I can't remember the exact words that I used, but I just pointed out to him and to others that were listening that what a great shame it was that the sacrifice of the martyrs of the IRA had been thrown away by recent governments subsuming Southern Ireland within the European Union, where all the independence, in inverted commas, had actually gained for them was the swapping of one dominant partner country for an even bigger, even more dominant partner country. So they had squandered the sacrifices of their patriots of the past, and that shut him up. And the same really goes to Scotland as well. The fact of the matter is that if you break the British Isles down into its component parts, and if you do what the European Union was trying to do with England, of breaking England down into smaller component parts as well, each one of those component parts would not have the critical mass to be an independent country in its own right. And with it, for Scotland to leave its a divorce from the rest of the United Kingdom, and then to immediately go and become part of the European Union, which is what the Scottish National Party want to do, then they would just become a tiny part of a massive European federal state over which they would have no influence whatsoever. And they would have far less influence than they have here in the United Kingdom, and they would then fall under the sway of the wishes of parts of Europe that have really got no historic links with Scotland. And so what would happen is that Scotland would be part of the European Union, but it would be a smaller part of the European Union than, for example, Poland or than Romania. And it would have less influence in those parts of less influence in Europe than those countries as well. And it's fairly telling that Boris Johnson, in discussions with the Southern Irish government, has recently been talking about Britain giving Southern Ireland 3.7 million doses of anti-COVID vaccine, because the Southern Irish government haven't been able to get anything like the quantities of the supplies of COVID vaccine through the European Union. And Scotland would find themselves in the same parlous situation if they were to break away from the rest of the United Kingdom. So it's all a complete fool's dream of an independent Scotland, because Scotland, just as England and just as Wales and Ireland, have far greater influence together as the British Isles than any component part would have individually as part of the European Union.
Yeah, it's the same sort of mentality there that tries to individualise us, and because it weakens us. If you have a group of individuals, they're much weaker than a group that identifies with one another. This is why they're against ethno-nationalism. And again, it's why the EU is trying to break up the United Kingdom. I also want to point out as well that I mean, it's almost like a bad joke the way that they call themselves the Scottish National Party or Scottish Nationalist Party, and they're all about internationalism. They couldn't get further removed from nationalism, and now you have Alex Salmond calling his party the Alba Party, the White Party. And of course, you know that he's going to be advocating for more refugees to come into Scotland, exactly the same platform as the Scottish National Party. I just find it insulting that they use these nationalist terms whilst being completely anti-nationalist, even more anti-nationalist than you could say that the Tories are or Labour are. It's just full-on communism up there in Scotland. I do feel sorry for the Scots because I think they've had the wool pulled over their eyes. They think Scottish National Party, they're standing up for us, they're speaking up for us, and I guess they just don't pay that much attention to what's actually going on politically. They just vote for them because it says Scottish in the name, and they think they're going to stand up for them. But they don't. They're actually standing up for communism and for the worst interests of the Scottish people. They just seem to want to replace the Scots. I mean, putting that Abu Hamza in charge of justice when he quite clearly hates white people, he's made it his life's goal to bring in this law to do away with the tradition of free speech that we have in the country. So I would really like to see the Scottish National Party lose out on lots of votes in this election, and I'd like to see the Conservative Party win lots of votes, as I say, because they're actually standing against this bill, and they're the only party that are. And if that happened, it would show that the Scots are starting to take an interest in politics, and they're not just voting for someone because they call themselves Scottish. Well, that's really the national news concerning white people within the country and the politics and the left and the right. Well, go on.
I'd just like to add that if the Scottish National Party was actually selling a product, a physical product, then they could be prosecuted under the Trade Descriptions Act. You know, what they actually are trying to deliver is, as you say, so far removed from what they claim to be wanting to deliver as to be a criminal misrepresentation, basically.
Yeah, that's a good point. Somebody should do that. Try and take the court under the Trades and Descriptions Act for claiming to represent the Scottish people when they don't. But we have some news from the Muslim community this week as well, and it really parallels what went on in France a couple of months ago when Samuel Paty, the French teacher, showed images of Muhammad in class and was then beheaded. Only he didn't actually show images of Muhammad in class. The girl in question, the pupil, just made that up, apparently. That's not very well known. It wasn't headline news, but yes, she actually just made that up. And we've had the same thing happen in Batley. We don't know whether this is actually just made up, but apparently one of the school teachers was doing a lesson on free speech and on blasphemy, and apparently he showed one of these Charlie Hebdo cartoons, and there's been absolute uproar since then. There's been hundreds of people outside the gates of the Batley school protesting. There are Muslim leaders that are calling on Boris Johnson to do something before Britain turns into France, which I think is a particularly chilling threat when you think that this school teacher over in France, he was beheaded. The Batley school teacher, instead of the school standing up for him like they did in France, the school have apologised for the teacher showing the heinous picture of the Prophet Muhammad. I don't know why I'm calling him the Prophet Muhammad, because he didn't actually make any prophecies that came true, as far as I'm aware. But the school have apologised for him instead of standing up for him, and the poor teacher has had to be taken away into hiding, where he now has police protection. And the way the press are talking about it, it's a terrible thing that this teacher did this. And of course, it's not a terrible thing that this teacher did this. It's a British tradition that we can show images of religious figures. It's a foreign tradition to have blasphemy laws. And that's what these Muslims are calling for. They're calling for blasphemy laws. There's been some quite interesting incidents where there's been leaders of the Muslim community and they've been pressed, and they did have to be really pressed to say that the beheading of that teacher in France was worse than actually showing an image of the Prophet. And when you look at the video footage of these protests, I mean, it does look like something out of Afghanistan or something out of Pakistan. You've got people with all dressed up in their Afghani national costume. You've got people that don't really speak very much English. You got people with hoods on and with masks covering up their face so that people can't identify them. Very, very threatening situation that is going on there. And it is ongoing. And I do fear for this teacher's safety. And it's absolute scandal that the school are not actually speaking up for him. Max, you got some thoughts on this Batley incident as well, haven't you?
Yeah, and I think that... there are two lines of thought, really. One is that there is a tradition in this country of freedom of speech, and as such, that it should be possible for things such as blasphemy to be discussed. And I firmly believe, from what I've read so far, that the teacher involved here simply showed an example of what is blasphemy. And the example of blasphemy that he showed was one of these Charlie Hebdo cartoons. And he wasn't stating that he thought that the cartoon was good, or that he thought that attacking Muhammad was bad, or anything of that. Attacking Muhammad was good, or anything of that sort. What he was doing was showing an example of blasphemy, so that the class could understand what blasphemy is. In the same way that there have been blasphemies committed against Jesus Christ over the years, and those have tended to be protected under the law, under the aegis of free speech. I think people do get annoyed sometimes when when blasphemies are committed, irrespective of the religion that's the victim of the blasphemy. The point I'd like to make, though, is that the people in this country, the Indigenous British people, I should say, the Indigenous British people have accepted that blasphemies do sometimes occur, and that blasphemies, whilst they should be discouraged, shouldn't require the death penalty to be applied to the person who's committed the blasphemy. Whereas under Muslim culture, the response to blasphemy is far more severe, in that the person who's blasphemed is regarded then as an apostate, and regarded as somebody who should pay the ultimate price for their sin. And this really is one of the key things that separates Muslim culture generally from the culture of the West. And this is one of the things that demonstrates the incompatibility of Muslim culture with the culture of the West. Going all the way back to Salman Rushdie with the Satanic Verses. Salman Rushdie wrote his book in which he was deemed to have insulted the Prophet, or deemed to have insulted Allah in some way. I've not read the book, so I don't know what he actually wrote, but that's what he's deemed. And he had to go into hiding for years because of the fatwa that was issued, the death sentence that was issued by a foreign imam. And then we've had, over the years, we've had Theo van Gogh being stabbed to death on the continent because of his support for his outspoken views with regard to Islam. We've had the Charlie Hebdo cartoons, which in 2015 resulted in 15 people being killed in an atrocious event that took place in Paris. And as you mentioned, we've had the more recently Samuel Paty being stabbed to death as a result of allegedly showing these same sort of cartoons to children in France. And I think that there's one thing we've got to make a choice. Either we accept Islam as being a part of British culture, in which case we then have to accept that anybody who insults either the Prophet Muhammad or Allah is should therefore be sentenced to death, and that the death sentence should be applied to them, or we decide that Muslim culture is incompatible with British culture, and we begin a process of removing people of and encouraging people of Muslim cultural descent, etc., to leave the country and go back to their countries of origin, where they can live in peace and in harmony with people that believe the same things that they believe.
Well, this is a thing. If you say to people they're trying to bring in blasphemy laws, people just look at you and say, well, how ridiculous. Of course they're not trying to bring in blasphemy laws. But that's exactly what these hate crime laws are. It's blasphemy laws by the back door, isn't it? And that's what these Muslims are protesting about. They're saying it should be hate speech to show an image of Muhammad. And that's the Muslims' argument there. They're saying that anything that they don't like in their religion, that should be hate speech and it should be against the law. But of course, it's not against the law for people to blaspheme Christianity or to take the Lord's name in vain. So they'll try and bring in these laws, these hate speech laws, but they will only really apply for Muslims. And that's what this bill is that's being brought in by Hamza Yousaf in Scotland. It's a de facto blasphemy law, because it means that if Muslims say they're offended by anything, then therefore it's hate speech and it should be banned. And we've also got the Batley itself, which is I think it's majority Muslim, and also this was where I've forgotten her name. What was the name of the lady that was killed, the MP Max that was killed there?
Joe Cox.
Yeah, you were saying something about the fact that it's majority Muslim and Joe Cox was killed there.
Well, Joe Cox was killed in Batley and Spen, which was her constituency, of which the Batley High School, or Grammar School rather, is part of. Batley Grammar School is on the border between Batley East and Batley West. Batley East is a majority Muslim part of Batley and Spen, whereas Batley West is not. There is a Muslim community in Batley West, but they are in a minority in that part there. And so, but the grammar school, from what I can see, serves both of those parts of Batley and Spen. And it's interesting that the press, who would normally have made reference to the fact that Batley Grammar School is in Batley and Spen, which is the constituency where Joe Cox was murdered, have been strangely avoiding making any mention of this whatsoever. And I believe it's because by drawing attention to the fact that there is this discord in Batley, kind of undermines the words that were spoken by Jo Cox during her maiden speech. And these words have been broadcast on television time and time again since Jo Cox's murder, as if because Jo Cox was murdered, therefore that everything she said was the saintly truth. And what she said during her maiden speech was that she said, "Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's a great privilege to be called to make my maiden speech. Batley and Spen is a gathering of typically independent, no-nonsense, proud Yorkshire towns and villages. Our communities have been deeply enhanced by immigration. Whilst we celebrate our diversity, the thing that surprises me time and time again as I travel around the constituency is that we are far more united and have far more in common than that which divides us." And, you know, the current hoo-ha in Batley, surrounding Batley Grammar School, actually proves that what Jo Cox said is untrue, that there is no truth to that. The fact that the communities are not deeply enhanced, the fact of the matter is that if there wasn't a multicultural society in Batley and Spen, this issue would never have occurred. The fact that a teacher showed a picture of a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad would never have happened. And so therefore, there would have been no offence given and no offence taken. And so what she said is not true whatsoever. And the words of Joe Cox were repeated by the current Labour MP who represents Batley and Spen, Tracy Brabin, during her maiden speech. She said, "What surprises me time," well, she basically quotes Joe Cox and says, "What surprises me time and time again as I travel around the constituency is that we're far more united and have far more in common than that which divides us." And what I would say to Tracy Brabin is that if indeed Batley in Spain is a gathering of typically independent, no-nonsense, proud Yorkshire towns, then she should get down to Batley Grammar School and, in her typically independent, no-nonsense, proud Yorkshire way, tell all of the demonstrators to go home and stop bothering a teacher who is just doing his job. But I don't think we'll see Tracy Brabin do that, because I think Tracy Brabin would have a very rude awakening if she ever attempted to do anything like that.
It just seems once Muslims reach a critical mass in an area, once they're over 60% in an area, then they feel emboldened to do things like this and put so much pressure on the teacher that he has to be hidden away out of public view and given police protection. And that is hardly a strength, is it? That's hardly united. That is hardly enhancing Britain to have teachers that have to be hidden away and given police protection just for doing their job, and so much pressure that the school is refusing to back him up. That's the really scandalous part of this, is that the school appears to be taking the side of the Muslims and saying, oh yes, you're right, he shouldn't have done it, when really they should be backing him up in the same way that the French education did. Well, shall we move on to our greatest Britons then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's get into our greatest Britons for the week. Our greatest Briton this week is David Livingstone. David Livingstone was born on the 19th of March 1813, and he died on the 1st of May 1873. He was a Scottish physician, a pioneer Christian missionary, an explorer in Africa, and one of the most popular British heroes of the late 19th century Victorian era. He had a mythic status that operated on a number of interconnected levels. Protestant missionary martyr, working class rags to riches inspirational story, scientific investigator, adventure explorer, imperial reformer, anti-slavery crusader, and advocate for British commercial and colonial expansion. Livingstone's fame as an explorer and his obsession with learning the sources of the Nile River was founded on the belief that if he could solve this age-old mystery, his fame would give him the influence he needed to end the East African Arab Swahili slave trade. The Nile sources, he told a friend, are valuable only as a means of opening my mouth with power among men. It is this power with which I hope to remedy an immense evil. His subsequent exploration of the Central African wilderness was the culmination of the classic period of European geographical discovery and the colonial penetration of Africa. At the same time, his missionary travels, his disappearance, and his eventual death in Africa, and subsequent glorification as a posthumous national hero in 1874, led to the founding of several major Central African Christian missionary initiatives carried forwards into the era of the European scramble for Africa. And he led a really exciting life. And what they really miss out there is that this idea he had of opening up Africa, once he'd done this exploration work and he'd mapped the rivers, the idea was that we could have trade in Africa, and the trade which we would have in Africa would help the Africans to replace the slave trade. So this idea that we went into Africa and we oppressed them and we took them as slaves and we're selling them to America, it's the complete opposite of that. The reason why we went in there was so that they could stop selling other Africans as slaves. And David Livingstone was really against this. It was his life's mission was to stop slavery. And he tried various different ways of doing it. And also this exploratory work and trying to find the sources of the Nile. He went on quite a few different expeditions, and we'll hear about some of the things that that happened in them. And as far as the Christian missionary work is concerned, he actually only succeeded in converting one of the natives to becoming Christian, and yet he's known as this great missionary, and really he didn't really have that much success with that. He had much more success with his exploratory work and also inspiring the British people, because it really is a rags to riches story, this one. Max, what are your thoughts on David Livingstone?
Well, I've not really seen quite how David Livingstone's life as yet perhaps interconnects with the life of Cecil Rhodes. But what I would say is that certainly, you know, from what you've said so far, that the thrust of David Livingstone's work is very much in keeping with what Cecil Rhodes did. And Cecil Rhodes obviously worked from South Africa and was exploring his way north and attempting to create this railway line that would extend all the way from Cape Town through to Cairo. And in searching for the source of the River Nile, it seemed that David Livingstone was working from in the opposite direction, trying to create a connection between the north of Africa and the south of Africa, which would have been in keeping with, as I say, Cecil Rhodes' ambitions. But also it seems that in doing work as a missionary, and certainly in doing work to eliminate slavery in Africa, that David Livingstone was working with many of the same goals as Cecil Rhodes.
Yeah, well, he paved the way for Cecil Rhodes, I think. If it hadn't been for the exploratory work that he did, Africa wouldn't have been opened up and Cecil Rhodes wouldn't have been able to go in there and modify things in the way that he did. Well, Livingstone was born on the 19th of March 1813 in the mill town of Blantyre, Scotland, in a tenement building for the workers of a cotton factory on the banks of the River Clyde. He was the second of seven children born to Neil Livingstone and his wife, Agnes. Neil Livingstone was a Sunday school teacher and a teetotaler who handed out Christian tracts on his travels as a door-to-door tea salesman, and he read books on theology, travel and missionary enterprises extensively. This rubbed off on the young David, who became an avid reader, but he also loved scouring the countryside for animal, plant and geological specimens in the local limestone quarries, sparking off an interest in the natural world. He was employed at the age of 10 in the cotton mill of Henry Monteith and Co. in Blantyre Works, where he and his brother John worked 12-hour days as piecers, tying broken cotton threads on the spinning machines, often while they were still in motion. Now, just think about that. You're 10 years old and you're working in a cotton mill. You're working a 12-hour day, and yet you're also spending time going around the countryside, learning about the natural world. You're also finding time to read. And when he was actually in the cotton mill, I mean, this is a dangerous job. These spinning machines are still in motion. This is at the time when we still had white children that were being sent up chimneys. We had white children that were working in these cotton mills. And at the same time as that, the British government were trying to stop slavery in America and stop black slavery, when we had these essentially white slaves that were working in Britain. And the reason for that is because they wanted to bring in the wage system, because it was actually cheaper to employ people and pay them wages than it was to maintain a slave with warmth and clothing and housing and food and medicine and all the rest of it. It was cheaper just to pay people an hourly wage or a daily wage than it actually was for slavery. And that was the real reason for them getting rid of slavery, which really destroys this notion that there was some oppression involved in slavery, or that the slaves weren't actually getting anything out of it, because in actual fact, they must have been getting more out of it than the people that were on wages, because it was cheaper to do it the other way around. I guess that David Livingstone wasn't aware of this. I mean, he just saw the way that these blacks were treated. He'd read about it. Don't forget, he hasn't actually gone to Africa yet. He's just read about this in Scotland, so he doesn't have any experience of it. So he's seen a lot of this this propaganda that is against slavery, alongside all the Christian teachings of his father. You got any thoughts on his early life here, Max?
Well, I think that his early life pretty much destroys the concept that we here in Britain enjoyed white privilege, and that it was as a result of the existence of the British Empire that we that all of our wealth was built on. Because David Livingstone, as you say, was working as a young boy in a very dangerous job, working 12 hours a day, and we often see these adverts on television for organisations that are charities in the third world, and they. They'll pick on an individual child and say about how, you know, little Mary has to walk 12 miles with a vase on her head so she can collect the water for the family, and therefore this is the reason for the poverty of her community and the reason for the poverty in Africa, and it's all the fault of us white people because we've not given them enough money. And in reality, if you look at the lives of people like David Livingstone, you know, they were born with very little more, and one would argue nothing more than the very people that are being portrayed in Africa as the sufferers of poverty that's been imposed upon them. Well, the example of David Livingstone is that if you're prepared to work hard and seize opportunities, then you can rise literally from rags to riches, and that there is no excuse really for other parts of the world blaming Britain for their poverty.
You know, especially when you look at the textile industry, because we do see adverts and it will show you some poor non-white child working in the textile industry, and we're being told they're being paid peanuts. Well, this is exactly what the white children were doing 150 years ago. They were working in the textile industry, and it was a lot more dangerous back then. And it is now, as we will hear, we'll hear about his job now, what he actually did. This job, piecing, involved repairing the sporadic yarn breakages. At the rollers, the broken yarn would be caught on the underclearer, while at the spindle, it would knot itself into a whirl on the spindle tip. If the break happened on the winding stroke, the spindle might have to be stopped while the thread was found and rejoined. But normally, this would be attempted while the machine was still moving. So think about that. You've got industrial machinery here. It's moving up and down. It's moving very fast. And you've got a 10-year-old child that is diving underneath it, diving all around it, trying to get these bits of thread so that he can tie it together. And, you know, you just know that there must have been loads of broken arms and kids getting their arms caught up in the rollers. I mean, it was a real brutal industry, basically, when you think of it.
Losing fingers.
Yeah, losing fingers, you know, damaging your limbs. And unlike the slaves, you know, they didn't have paid for medical care if they were injured. This is one of the things that the slaves had that the ordinary employed didn't have.
Breathing air thick with cotton dust in a confined space for 12 hours a day. Just imagine what that did to their lungs.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, how did they manage to clean themselves? They probably weren't that clean either. And you think this is somebody in a family of seven, and his father is a preacher. So, I mean, you think about preachers today, they're middle class, aren't they? Vicars. So, I mean, this is what the middle class were like. This is what work was like. 12 years old, and you would have to be working in this dangerous job. The number of yarn breakages was dependent on the quality of the roving, and quality cotton led to fewer breakages. Typically, 1,200 spindle mules of the 1920s would experience 5 to 6 breakages a minute. 5 to 6 of these would happen a minute. So, I mean, you're going to need a lot of kids running around tying this up and you know, falling over themselves trying to get this done. The two pieces were needed to repair the thread within the 15 to 20 seconds that the mule was in motion. But once they actually had the thread, it took under 3 seconds, and the repair itself involved a slight rolling of the forefinger against the thumb. So this isn't just waiting around for a breakage that's going to happen, I don't know, once an hour or something like that. This is, you know, this is all the time, 5 to 6 breakages a minute. And they're literally just going to be on their feet all day for 12 hours a day. Livingstone's experiences in the cotton mill were from the ages of 10 to 26, first as a piecer and later as a spinner. This monotonous work was necessary for him to support his impoverished family, but it also taught him persistence, endurance, and a natural empathy with all who labour, as expressed by lines that he used to hum from the Rabbi Burns song, "When man to man the world o'er, shall brothers be for that." And I don't really understand what he's saying there, but I guess it's solidarity between the workers of the world. I guess he did must have had a bit of a left-wing leaning. It does sound like it. Max, you got any thoughts on that? Any extra thoughts?
Well, I would agree with your interpretation of that line from Livingstone. Just good, really, that as far as the people who are campaigning for the destruction of statues of everybody great in Britain, that they've left Livingstone alone so far, and so hopefully the example that he set and the philosophy that he followed in his life can remain as part of our culture and can inspire future generations.
I bet it's only time until they go for David Livingstone, because of course he was white. Well, he attended Blantyre Village School along with a few other mill children with the endurance to do so, despite their 14-hour working day, which was 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. I mean, just when did they have the time to do this? I guess it must have been Sunday school, because they would have had time off for church, so school would have just been in the Sunday afternoon. Having a family with a strong ongoing commitment to study helped to reinforce his desire for education. After reading an appeal for medical missionaries to China in 1834, he began saving his money to enter Anderson's University, Glasgow, which he did in 1836, while also attending Greek and theology lectures at the University of Glasgow. To enter medical school, he required some knowledge of Latin and was tutored by a local Roman Catholic man, Daniel Gallagher. In addition to his other studies, he attended divinity lectures by Wardlaw, who was a leader at this time of vigorous anti-slavery campaigning in the city. Shortly after, he applied to join the London Missionary Society and was accepted, subject to completing missionary training, which he did while studying at the Charing Cross Hospital Medical School, with his courses covering medical practice, midwifery and botany. The missionary training was carried out in London and in Ongar, Essex, where he learned to be a minister within the Congregational Union, serving under the LMS. And I guess they were good things for him to learn if he's going out there to Africa, ostensibly to help these African tribal people, midwifery and medical practice, and at the same time botany, so that he can record the flora and the fauna that he finds there. And while training under the LMS, he and the other students were taught Greek, Latin, Hebrew and theology by the Reverend Richard Cecil. Despite his impressive personality, Livingstone was a plain preacher, described by Cecil as worthy but remote from brilliant. And he would have been rejected by the LMS had the director not given him a second chance to pass the course. He eventually qualified as a licentiate of the Faculty of Physicians and Surgeons of Glasgow on the 16th of November 1840, and was later made an honorary fellow of the faculty on the 5th of January 1850. So, I mean, this is a really dedicated man to come from working in these cotton mills and then only being taught on a Sunday at his Sunday school, and then he goes on to university where he learns Greek, Latin, Hebrew and theology, and learns these practical courses as well, because he wants to be a missionary. He wants to do what he can for other people. You know, this is what we're like as white people. We're very charitable people, and a lot of us wish to dedicate our lives to helping others, whether it's in the medical industry or whether it's through being a missionary, whether it's even through people joining the army and wishing to lay down their lives for others. It's all about this desire to do things for the group, and that is an ethnic it's an ethnic instinct of wanting to do what you can for your family and wanting to do what you can for your extended family, but this is being extended beyond that, and he's wanting to do what he can for the other families of the world, which is really a credit to white people, and for us to then be called racist when, you know, we have large groupings of our people that just dedicate their lives to doing things for other peoples, whether that's right or wrong. You have to say, well, this shows that white people are incredibly generous and incredibly charitable. And David Livingstone was a good example of this. Do you want to make any comments on that, Max?
Just to agree with you, but also to say that all this studying that Livingstone did was also presumably during the period that he would have been working in order to provide for himself at the same time.
Yes, he would have had to work and fund this as well, and he was also paying for his family. It's a hard work, and what was this, 170 years ago, basically. Livingstone had hoped to go to China as a missionary, but the First Opium War broke out in September 1840 while he was continuing his medical studies in London. when he met LMS missionary Robert Moffat on leave from Kuruman, a missionary outpost in South Africa, north of the Orange River. He was excited by Moffat's vision of expanding missionary work northwards, and this, combined with an influence from the abolitionist T.F. Buxton's arguments that the African slave trade might be destroyed through the influence of legitimate trade and the spread of Christianity, led to Livingstone focusing his ambitions on southern Africa instead. So two reasons there why he went to Africa, because there were these problems in China, and also because he's starting to get this feel of wanting to put a stop to slavery. And you can see this idea of legitimate trade, a large part of the reasoning for setting up this trade was to help do away with slavery. It wasn't to rip the Africans off or oppress them in any way. Well, Livingstone was deeply influenced by his missionary friend Moffat's judgment that he was the right person to go to the vast plains north of Bechuanaland, where he had glimpsed the smoke of 1,000 villages where no missionary had ever been. During this time, he visited Mabotsa, Botswana, an area where there were many lions terrorizing the villagers. They stated, "The lion, the lord of the night, kills our cattle and sheep, even in the daytime." And Livingstone felt that if he could kill just one lion, the others would take it as a warning and leave the villages and their livestock alone. Therefore, he led the villagers on a lion hunt, and seeing a large lion, he fired his gun. But the animal was not injured enough to prevent it from attacking him while he was reloading, and he seriously wounded his left arm. The broken bone, even though set by himself with the help of a missionary's daughter, bonded strongly, and he was still able to shoot and lift weights, but it remained a source of much suffering for the rest of his life, and he was not able to lift his arm any higher than his shoulder. So this tells us what it was like for these Africans. You know, they did live in fear of lions, much the same as we would have lived in fear of wolves, I guess, some years ago. Do you want to add anything there, Max?
I think that he showed his lack of experience as a hunter by not having somebody else stood by the side of him with a loaded gun whilst he reloaded. But certainly being attacked by a lion is the sort of thing that would end in death for most people, and so he was lucky to escape with his life.
Yeah, he's taken a lot of risks there. That's a good point there. But I wonder if he could have trusted any of these Africans with one of these guns. And I guess he had other missionaries there, because he had the missionary's daughter that was helping him. So, yeah, he really wasn't thinking ahead there. Obviously not used to hunting. Well, Livingstone was obliged to leave his first mission at Mabotsa in 1845 after irreconcilable differences emerged between him and his fellow missionary, Roger Edwards, and because the Bagatla were proving indifferent to the gospel. He abandoned his next mission too in Chonawane because of drought, the close proximity of the Boers, and his desire to move on to the regions beyond. Finally, at the Kolobeng mission in 1849, Livingstone converted his first and only African chief, Sechelle, after 2 years of patient persuasion. Livingstone is known as Africa's greatest missionary, yet he is recorded as having converted only one African, Sechelle, who was the chief of the Kwena people of Botswana. Sechelle was born in 1812, and his father died when Sechelle was just 10, and two of his uncles divided the tribe between themselves, forcing Sechelle to leave his home for 9 years. When he returned, he took over one of his uncle's tribes, and at that point he met Livingstone, who was known throughout a large part of Africa for treating the natives with respect, and that respect being responded to with faith and loyalty. He could never permanently convert the tribesmen to Christianity, however. Among other reasons, Sechelle, by then the leader of the African tribe, did not like the way that Livingstone did not demand rain of his god like his rainmakers did, who boasted that they could. After long hesitation from Livingstone, he finally baptized Sechelle and encouraged the church to completely embrace him. But Sechelle, who is now a part of the church, continued to act according to his African culture, which went against Livingstone's teachings. Being no different from any other man in his tribe, he believed in polygamy, and he had 5 wives. So when Livingstone told him to get rid of 4 of them, it shook the Kwena tribe to its foundations. After finally divorcing the 4 women, Livingstone baptized them all, and everything went well. However, 1 year later, one of his ex-wives became pregnant and Seychelles was the father. He begged Livingstone not to give up on him because his faith was still strong, but Livingstone left the country and went north to continue his Christianizing attempts. After Livingstone had left the Kwena tribe, we are told that Seychelles remained faithful to Christianity and he led missionaries to other surrounding tribes as well, converting nearly his entire Kwena people. In the estimation of Neil Parsons of the University of Botswana, Seychelles did more to propagate Christianity in 19th century southern Africa than virtually any single European missionary did. Although Seychelles saw himself as a Christian, many European missionaries disagreed, as the Kwena tribe leader kept rainmaking as a part of his life, as well as polygamy. Well, what this shows is that Livingstone must have made a very, very big impression on this tribal chief, this Seychelles, and he must have done because he tried to convert his people. But at the same time, it shows us that they have their ethnic drives and they have their traditions, and they're not going to give up those traditions. They're not going to give up the traditions of polygamy, because that's the way that they live. They have many wives, they have many children, they have a very, very fast life history strategy. They don't invest lots of time in these children because life is very cheap there, as we see with the lion. People are going to be dying a lot. I should imagine a lot of his children died. And if he was just to limit himself to one wife, he may end up with all of his children dying. You need to have many wives, you need to have many children so that he can be looked after in his old age. A completely different way of living to the way that we live in the West, where we invest a lot of time in producing our children and in educating them, and we don't have that many of them because we have a completely different way of doing things. So you can see that the Christian religion did not fit very well with the actual way of living of these Africans. You got any comments on that, Max?
I think your interpretation there is quite true. Actually, I think it was perhaps a little bit naive of Livingstone to expect the complete conversion of African tribes in one fell swoop, and that it's pretty obvious really from his experience there that it would take a lot of waves of Christianizing, wave upon wave, in order to eventually instill Christianity along the European model. And it was only to be expected that Christianity would have to bend to some extent to accept African culture if it was to become acceptable to the people of Africa.
You know, I do find it ironic that today it's really only the African church that is sticking to the traditional Christian morality. It's only the African church that still makes homosexuality illegal and makes divorce illegal and all these traditional Christian things that they were taught 150 years ago. And now they look over here at the West and they see the West having transsexual coronations in the churches and allowing gay weddings, and they're absolutely mystified and scandalized by this. And you know, it's the African church is really shaming the European churches at the moment by actually sticking to these Christian traditions. I just find that very ironic. Well, we should probably leave that there, Max, unless you've got anything else that you'd like to add.
I was just going to agree with you, actually, that it was extremely ironic that the African tribes have stuck to the traditional Christianity and are mystified by the way that the church purports itself over here in Europe.
And also, the churches back then, they didn't want to accept Seychelles. That, you know, they said, well, he's not really a proper Christian. He still has these extra wives, and yet they ended up being the ones sticking to the law rather than us.
Yeah, it's a strange old world we live in, isn't it?
Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
That's my pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.